The views expressed in this program are those of the participants.
Dear Mr. President, Your Honor, Sir.
What have you got down so far?
Dear Mr. President, Your Honor, Sir.
Yeah, go on.
Here, I got a good idea. You come over here. Come here. Yeah, come on over. Now you sit down there and you write what I dictate.
Oh, Archie. Oh, I don't know. I'm too nervous. It's to the president.
What are you nervous about? I'm going to do the whole thing. Now, go ahead. You just write what I tell you. Now, what do you got there?
Dear Mr. President, Your Honor,
oh,
sir.
That's lousy.
What?
What you read.
That's what you wrote.
I know, but you read it so rotten.
I think it was the words.
Just read them same words over again, will you? Never read them with a little feeling, huh? Go ahead.
Dear Mr. President, Your Honor, Sir.
Yes, beautiful words. Dear Mr. President, Your Honor, Sir. Edith, this is going to be good, you know that? Yeah. I think Mr. Nixon is going to love this.
Ladies and gentlemen, from the East Room of the White House, the President of the United States.
My fellow Americans, tonight I want to read you a letter I've just received from a private citizen. It starts, of course, with a highly proper, Dear Mr. President, Your Honor, Sir. Now let me make one thing perfectly clear. I love that beginning.
Welcome, everyone. It is Wednesday, April 24th, 2024. I'm Bob Metz, and this is Just Right, broadcasting around the world and online. Join us for an hour of discussion that's not right-wing. It's Just Right.
Fade into color, and color into black and white. Under the bedclothes, everything will be all right.
I wonder what All in the Family's Archie Bunker might have written as an opening salutation to President Joe Biden. For a clue, just wait till you hear what Archie Bunker says in our show closer today. You'd swear that he was the Alex Jones of political predictions. I would venture at this point in our history that the very words politics and politicians are becoming repulsive to most people. And that's fully understandable and justifiable given our current crop of politicians and our dysfunctional democratic institutions. Corrupt to the core. And proud of it. But what makes them so repulsive is that whether liberal or conservative, they all practice the politics of the left. And what's even infinitely more frustrating for someone like me, who's had perhaps the most unique grounded experience and bird's eye view of being involved in politics for half a century plus, is that the overwhelming majority of the public still has no idea whatever of what two of the simplest words in politics mean, the words left and right. In fact, they so confuse the two opposite polarized terms with each other that the only way I can effectively describe the confusion is to refer to it as a form of political dyslexia. Now, the dictionary defines dyslexia as a, quote, learning disorder marked by impairment of the ability to recognize and comprehend written words, an impaired ability to read, a learning disability in which a person finds it difficult to read and write, end quote. Well, that definition describes the condition of dyslexia, but not its symptoms, some of which you'll hear illustrated on today's show. In particular, some of the most recognized symptoms of dyslexia are things like confusing the orders of the letters in a given textual word, confusing a B with a D or a P with a Q. I mean, these letters are a kind of mirror image of each other, aren't they? The good news about dyslexia is that it is easily treatable. But when it comes to political dyslexia, most people don't even want the cure because they see no value in it either way. That's how repulsive and irrelevant politics has become for many. But as we said so many times in the past, whether or not you are interested in politics, politics is interested in you. And if you still can't tell the difference between left and right, or if you still don't understand the basic language and concepts of politics in an objective way, you will become a servant and never be the master of your own supposedly representative democratic government. Three more political terms that practically no one comprehends. Representative, democratic, and government. So let's try to straighten out the mess, shall we? It all begins right after our reminder that you can write us at feedback@justrightmedia.org. Hear us on WBCQ Shortwave. Follow and like us on your favorite podcast platform, and visit us at justrightmedia.org, where you can access all of our social media links, archive broadcasts, and the support button that makes it easy for you to support the show. Because as always, your financial support is appreciated and is what makes this show possible. Now, it's been my observation that most people do not like living under the conditions of a tyranny. It's also been my observation that most people on this planet do in fact live under some variable condition of tyranny. Why is this? And more to the point, how did supposedly democratic countries operating under the principle of the consent of the governed possibly become so tyrannical? So let's kick off that conversation with our first two selected audio bites. On the return side of our upcoming bumper, the question of why democracy leads to tyranny is explicitly answered and described in a March 30 edition of the Academy of Ideas, while on this side of our bumper, Neil Oliver in his April 19th commentary offers us an example of how politics and politicians are becoming repulsive to most people, and actually goes so far as to declare himself a political atheist, the very theme we discussed last month on March 13th in our show entitled Political Atheism, the Loss of Faith in Democracy.
When all else fails, they take you to war. So said US trends forecaster Gerald Celente this week, and not for the first time. Celente describes himself as a political atheist, and I've taken that for my own, as well as his line about war. I used to say I was politically homeless, but to be homeless implies a desire for a home somewhere. But I will never look to politics or politicians for a home of any sort, not now and perhaps never again. An atheist says there's no God, and a political atheist knows politics is the mother of all confidence tricks. When it comes to politics, there's nothing there. Celente was a guest this week of George Galloway, MP, on his online Mother of All talk shows. Galloway talked about the Hoor's Den that is the Palace of Westminster. Recently returned to the Mother of All dunghills as MP for Rochdale, he must hold his nose whenever he stands to speak and so breathe the fetid air of the Chamber of the Commons. He endeavoured to have his colleagues contemplate the Third World War, already well underway. We're not supposed to have noticed World War III is up and running. Generations remembering what they've been invited to know of World War II, the stuff of movies now, think it will only be a real war when the bombs fall on their cities, when the young men are marched away. But make no mistake, I say, World War III is already here. The difference is that since the nuclear option is among us, the warmongers who have no intention of getting their windows broken or their limousines scratched, far less seeing a threat to their vast wealth, are carefully waging World War III in ways they think the little people won't notice. For the time being, the warmongers in the UK Parliament and in the broader establishment seek to reap the rewards of all the hate they've sown via bought and paid for media, via bought and paid for elected representatives. For those people and regimes we've been goaded into viewing with nothing but loathing. Among much that bamboozles me now is why we keep interviewing those wastes of space we call MPs, so-called reporters, still asking them questions, straight-faced, when their time might be better spent asking fleas about the decisions likely to be taken by the horse they're sucking blood from. They won't talk about war, at least not until they've been handed the latest script from whoever tells them what to say. Dennis Healy, a ghost from a bygone age, said MPs needed a hinterland, by which he meant they had to have more going on in their lives than just preening in Parliament like peacocks, but with smaller brains than peacocks. Part of our tragedy now is that the House of Commons is, with a handful of exceptions, filled with people who know nothing about anything and care less. That's true not just here in the UK, but of politicians across the West. French philosopher and writer Joseph de Maistre said, "Every nation has the government it deserves. If that's true, and we truly deserve that which we have, then God forgive us and God help us."
Remember, democracy never lasts long. It soon wastes, exhausts, and destroys itself. It is in vain to say democracy is less proud, less selfish, less ambitious, or less avaricious than aristocracy or monarchy. It is not true, in fact, and nowhere appears in history. Those passions are the same in all men under all forms of simple government, and when unchecked, produce the same effects of fraud, violence, and cruelty. In every age, there is a set of beliefs that are elevated to a sacred status, and questioning them is deemed heretical. For centuries, it was the dogmas of Christianity that possessed this status. Today, it is the dogma of the democratic state. Democracy, as currently practiced, is the greatest form of government, and anyone who denies this commits blasphemy, or so we are taught. But just as much of the Christian dogma was a veil to protect the power of the church, the same can be said about democracy. Democracy, with its political campaigns, elections, and the illusion of rule by the people, is a veil behind which politicians and bureaucrats parasitically enrich themselves while imposing their corruptive vision of society on the rest of us. Conceived as the foundation of liberty, modern democracy paves the way for tyranny. Born for the purpose of standing as a bulwark against power, it ends by providing power with the finest soil it has ever had in which to spread itself over the social field. There are many institutions that are necessary for a free and prosperous society. These include free markets, the division of labor, a rule of law that promotes order and trust, strong families, sound money, a school system that educates instead of indoctrinates, and a robust media that pursues the truth instead of spreading propaganda. If a democracy preserves these institutions, then one can claim that it is a form of political organization conducive to social harmony. But if a democracy continually produces governments that destroy these institutions, then the value of democracy must be questioned. Across the globe, the governments of most democracies are doing the latter. From the family unit to schooling, the media, free markets, sound money, or the rule of law, politicians and bureaucrats are actively destroying, or at least severely corrupting, these institutions. Why is this? What are the flaws of modern-day democracies that are leading it to manifest such corrupt governments? To answer this question, we must distinguish between two types of democracy: direct democracy and indirect democracy. A direct democracy involves citizens casting votes on specific issues, usually by means of a referendum. In a direct democracy, majority rules. Whether one views this form of political organization in a positive or negative light will usually depend on if one belongs to the majority or minority. Those in the majority tend to believe that direct democracy is a good system, as it leads to the satisfaction of their wants, while those in the minority often feel that direct democracy is nothing more than a tyranny of the masses. Democracy is two wolves and a lamb voting on what they are going to have for lunch, Benjamin Franklin famously remarked. While the 19th century British politician Oberon Herbert had this to say concerning the morality of a direct democracy: "Five men are in a room. Because three men take one view and two another, Have the three men any moral right to enforce their view on the other two men? What magical power comes over the three men that because they are one more in number than the two men, therefore they suddenly become possessors of the minds and bodies of these others? As long as they were two to two, so long we supposed each man remained master of his own mind and body. But from the moment that another man, acting heaven only knows from what motives, has joined himself to one party or the other, that party has become straightway possessed of the souls and bodies of the other party. Was there ever such a degrading and indefensible superstition? A tyranny of the masses, however, is not the most serious threat facing the West, as we live in indirect democracies which render most people politically impotent, and the power of the masses relatively negligible. In an indirect or representational democracy, we vote for politicians who are then, in theory, supposed to represent our interests. But how representational democracy should work in theory is not how it works in practice. In almost all democratic countries, a small number of political candidates are pre-selected by a handful of political parties that monopolize each country's political system, and from these candidates we vote for the ones we prefer, or at least dislike, the least. Once elected, far from being forced to represent the interests of the majority, politicians can, and frequently do, serve their own interests. Or as Frank Karsten and Carol Beckman note in their book Beyond Democracy, it is not the will of the people, but the will of politicians, prompted by groups of professional lobbyists, interest groups, and activists, that reigns in a democracy. Many will counter that a benefit of an indirect democracy is that we can vote out the corrupt politicians who fail to serve us. The problem, however, is that modern democracies rarely produce honest and ethical political candidates. Each time one corrupt politician is voted out of office, he or she is replaced by another corrupt politician who merely serves different special interest groups. Furthermore, nation-states have grown so large that most of the state actors who rule over us and implement the policies that affect us on a day-to-day basis are bureaucrats who are not subject to popular elections. And herein lies perhaps the most serious flaw of modern democracies. The democratic process seems incapable of preventing the worst from rising to the top in government.
Of course, the democracy discussed by the Academy of Ideas is really about the process of majority rule, termed a direct democracy, which is not democracy but is mob rule, plain and simple. A democracy is any socio-political condition which governs or rules with the consent of the governed, a concept we'll be delving into during the final quarter of today's show. As to the workings and consequences of an indirect representative democracy, which again I would distinguish as an indirect electoral voting process, the major question, nonetheless, is why such systems rarely produce ethical candidates, and why have such systems been incapable of preventing the worst from rising to the top in government? Well, the question falsely suggests that this is a flaw with the voting process, when in fact, the reason the worst rise to the top in government is because voters vote for them. The democracy part is working perfectly. God forgive us and God help us, laments Neil Oliver in his previous monologue, in acknowledging that every nation has the government it deserves, and in observing that the British House of Commons is made up of people who know nothing about anything, he's merely pointing to the inevitable result of their being elected by voters who know less than nothing about anything. I mean, how many times have you heard me say that it ain't so much about what people don't know that gets them into trouble, it's about what they do know that just ain't so? And wait till you hear about what Roseanne Barr has to say about this reality in the moments ahead. But when Neil Oliver defeatedly says that he's become a political atheist who believes that when it comes to politics, there is nothing there, he's closed the door to the possibility of changing that. And when he says that there's nothing there, what is lacking, the nothing, is any true representation on the right. The right is not there. The left is, and the left, quite literally, is nothing, to the point of nihilism. When you elect any leftist politicians, they're going to make sure that you're left for dead. Now, the Academy of Ideas pointed out that the institutions necessary for a free and prosperous society included free markets, division of labor, rule of law that promotes order and trust, strong family, sound money, a school system that educates and doesn't indoctrinate, and a media that seeks the truth instead of spreading propaganda. Well, while those are some of the institutions necessary for a free society, the conditions that must exist for any of those institutions to function are freedom and capitalism, based on the principle of individualism. Now, coming up next on this side of our bumper, Roseanne Barr, in conversation with Russell Brand on his April 18 show, offers a near-perfect demonstration of her own political dyslexia and how she overcame it as she recounts her experience from being an out-and-out leftist socialist to her ultimate support of Donald Trump. And on the return side of the bumper, Stu Peters leads the charge against America's NPR and NPR CEO Catherine Marr, whose recent public dismissal of the concept of truth revealed an agenda that even all of her harshest critics that I've heard so far have completely missed or ignored. See if you can spot it yourself. And here's the hint. Why would she want to dismiss any consideration of the truth?
Roseanne, thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Like, I wonder, Roseanne, because a lot of our audience may not know that you stood for leader of the Green Party, that you've been outspoken on a number of issues, that you were pretty vocal Democrat supporter, I feel like, at times in your career before supporting Donald Trump. I wonder where you are in the culture right now. How do you feel sort of generally cynical and skeptical?
You know what? I haven't changed at all. I have the exact same thoughts and beliefs that I had when I first came to Hollywood, as a stand-up comic that wanted to, talk about just regular people who do all the work that makes everything go, and unappreciated working class, and class politics. I haven't changed any of my views whatsoever, but the hourglass, they do those hourglass flips in the mind control program of the mass media, they do these hourglass flips. And so they did a total hourglass flip where suddenly the left that I was, I did run for president in 2012 as a socialist. And all of a sudden, that left and the left that I was raised in, because my parents were socialists too, and their parents, but that left, well, we cared about freedom of speech and we cared about, civil rights and bettering yourself with education and moving up. And all of that flipped. And now it's like the left is not, as I always say, well, the left doesn't seem like your daddy's left anymore. Now it's just a kind of a fascist structure that hates civil rights, hates freedom of speech, hates individual rights, and just says no, just authoritarian and just repressive, putting its big, can we swear on your show?
Yes.
Rubbing its fucking huge jackboot into your face and grinding it into the goddamn dirt. Because all they do is just go where there's a big pile of money and rob it, that. So, they scope out where there's money and then they can go there and steal it and destroy the people that have it. But it may have always been that way, but I didn't perceive it that way because I had that thing that leftists have where you see fake kind of make-believe happy world where you believe that you're compassionate. You don't really see how fascist you are until, I'm speaking in the past. I didn't realize all of that stuff about the left until I left the left slowly to go, oh my God, look how they do. Because when I ran for president in the Green Party and socialist structures, I really believed it was about something different. And then when I saw how
it was just about graft and grifting, just like the right. And I was like, man, they're the very same thing. There's not two parties. There's one. Like my friend Gore Vidal said, there's just one party, and it's the money party. And they'll put one guy in the window till the people are tired of being robbed, and they go throw the bums out, and then they'll put the other party in the window till the people are tired of being robbed, throw the bums out, and then they'll put the same first party. You know, and that's what I mean by the hourglass flip. There's very little difference in either of them, and even narrowing even more, you know, where it's just like, you know, we mean to take everything from you, and you're just going to have to get used to it.
But what struck me as more astonishing is when values like free speech were cast out, when the pharmaceutical industry were embraced as heroes, when censorship was legitimized, yeah, when war became cooler than peace. That's when I started, right, to think, hey, maybe they never liked working people in the first place and just used working people for a while in the same way that perhaps now they use different, inverted commas, minority groups, ethnic groups, sexual identity groups as a kind of mask for what appears to be a type of avarice that seeks to legitimize itself by pretending that they're somehow doing something for vulnerable people.
I mean, it's just like the devil, you know, if you get really fundamentalistic religion in some way, you can understand it. It just is the devil.
Yeah.
I can understand when people go and say that. I mean, it's easier to communicate with people who think that way than it is to communicate with people who talk about, you know, stock prices. It's just too out there, and it just makes no sense at all for living human beings who think, you know?
Yeah, you're right. Like a sort of a Luciferian metaphor, or metaphors derived, right, from scripture, or metaphors that acknowledge the existence of good and evil, make more sense and seem to have more value and have more utility than just the endless doubling down on rationalism, especially when it seems that rationalism, as I said before, can be used to justify whatever they want to do.
They just want us dead. They want to experiment on us first, and so they can like make a lot of money on cures and, you know, stuff that they do. But they want us all dead. But here's what's great. It's right in front of our face. They put it right in front of our face, and then we don't see it, like hiding in plain sight, you know.
Yeah.
The war on carbon. I mean, come on. We are carbon.
Carbon's what all life is made of, all material life. Carbon and, I mean, the war on consciousness is already actually underway, I think.
I think they may have won it.
There is one media organization that everyone seems to agree is run by the government and living off the people, and that's NPR. Though they'll tell you they're as legitimate news outlet as anyone else, they even quit X over being labeled state-funded media, which they are. NPR likes to portray itself, and it's often seen as this benign, policy-oriented news source. It's bland, it's drab, it's about as boring as a radio network or a news website as you could possibly find. But recently, we've learned that NPR, the state-funded media apparatus of our federal government under CEO Catherine Maher, is actively censoring and sacking employees who object to what one now former NPR objector named Uri Berliner called a rampant left-wing bias. Before his resignation on Wednesday, Berliner, a veteran editor at NPR, was suspended without pay after writing an essay in the Free Press accusing his employer of giving NPR listeners and readers, quote, the distilled worldview of a very small segment of the U.S. population, through a left-wing prism relevant to an even smaller segment of the population. And that seems to be exactly what NPR leadership wants to do, because they're doubling down on their support of Catherine Maher, the tyrant. In a public resignation announcement, Uri Berliner wrote, quote, I'm resigning from NPR, a great American institution where I've worked for 25 years. I don't support calls to defund NPR. I respect the integrity of my colleagues and wish for NPR to thrive and do important journalism. But I cannot work in a newsroom where I am disparaged by a new CEO whose divisive views confirm the very problems at NPR I cite in my free press essay. End quote. But you see, that's what Catherine Maher does for a living. It's what she's always done. Before she was stifling free speech at NPR, she was rewriting reality as the CEO of Wikipedia. And as the story around Uri Berliner continues to unfold, video footage of Catherine Maher talking to the globalist war hawks at the Atlantic Council is circulating now. It's going viral all over the place. And it shows her talking about how when she was heading up Wikipedia, she was working directly with the federal government, taking censorship orders from them. Shaping Wikipedia, which, as the name suggests, is supposed to be an encyclopedic website, in the image of the global homo deep state that's taken up residence in Washington, D.C. And this is like something out of 1984. The government and its technocrats can rewrite history. They can rewrite reality at any time that they want, and they're not shy about it. They're proud of it. They brag about it amongst themselves. Watch.
We took a very active approach to disinformation and misinformation coming into not just the last election, but also looking at how we supported our editing community in an unprecedented moment where we were not only dealing with the global pandemic, we were dealing with a novel virus, which by definition means we knew nothing about it in real time, and we're trying to figure it out as the pandemic went along. And so we really set up in response to both the pandemic, but also in response to the upcoming US election, and as a model for future elections outside of the US, including a number that are happening this year, we just obviously went through yet another Israeli election. The model was around how do we create sort of a clearinghouse of information that brings the institution of the Wikimedia Foundation with the editing community in order to be able to identify threats early on through conversations with government, of course, as well as other platform operators to understand sort of what the landscape looks like.
This woman is a disgusting creature of the deep state and its public-private partnerships that make sure that whatever the government can't control directly, it can control through its organizational minions, like Maher. Now, obviously, this video of Catherine Maher goes hand in hand with the story of Uri Berliner, but this woman gets even worse. A while back, she actually gave a TED Talk. And during that talk, she bragged all about how, as the CEO of Wikipedia, she was able to decide for everyone else, for you, what's true and what's not. And after she decided what the truth entailed, she was able to then decide whether or not the general public was even allowed to know the truth, because the truth, she said, can get in the way. Look.
But what about the hard things, the places where we are prone to disagreement, say politics and religion? Well, as it turns out, not only does Wikipedia's model work there, it actually works really well. Because in our normal lives, these contentious conversations tend to erupt over disagreement about what the truth actually is. But the people who write these articles, they're not focused on the truth. They're focused on something else, which is the best of what we can know right now. And after 7 years of working with these brilliant folks, I've come to believe that they are onto something, that perhaps for our most tricky disagreements, seeking the truth and seeking to convince others of the truth might not be the right place to start. In fact, our reverence for the truth might be a distraction that's getting in the way of finding common ground and getting things done. Now, that is not to say that the truth doesn't exist, nor is it to say that the truth isn't important. Clearly, the search for the truth has led us to do great things, to learn great things. But I think if I were to really ask you to think about this, one of the things that we could all acknowledge is that part of the reason we have such glorious chronicles to the human experience and all forms of culture is because we acknowledge there are many different truths. And so in the spirit of that, I'm certain that the truth exists for you, and probably for the person sitting next to you. But this may not be the same truth. This is because the truth of the matter is very often, for many people, what happens when we merge facts about the world with our beliefs about the world. So we all have different truths. They're based on things like where we come from, how we were raised, and how other people perceive us.
You are listening to Just Right, broadcasting around the world and online. You know, at first I assumed that Catherine Marr needed a dictionary, but upon reconsideration, especially after hearing what she just said, it became obvious that that would be the last thing she would want. Truth is the recognition of reality. Reason, man's only means of knowledge, is his only standard of truth, notes the Ayn Rand lexicon, which continues, the truth or falsehood of all man's conclusions, inferences, thought, and knowledge rests on the truth or falsehood of his definitions. Well, to claim that there are many different truths already begins with a false definition of truth. If I say 2 plus 2 equals 4 and someone else says that 2 plus 2 equals 5, there is no way that you're going to argue that these are different truths. The truth is that there are not, quote-unquote, many different truths, but that there are many different lies and errors. It's biblical. And it's logical. The road to truth always follows the narrowest path, for the very reason that the path to truth always leads to the one truth. But no, Catherine Marr insists that we all have different truths. They're based on things like where we come from, how we were raised, and how other people perceive us. Well, these are not truths. They are just facts and circumstances. And while it can always be said that facts are true to the extent that they are factual, facts alone do not constitute the truth. Truth is in the narrative. Great fictions often contain great truths, even though the fictional facts and circumstances do not actually exist. Which brings us back to the question I raised earlier. Why would Catherine Marr want to dismiss any consideration of the truth? She made it very clear in the one part of her statement that actually was the only truth in her entire diatribe. Quote, our reverence for truth might be a distraction that's getting in the way of finding common ground and getting things done, end quote. You know what that is? That's tyranny talking. To suggest that truth is getting in the way of finding common ground is to declare that disagreement must not be allowed. And what possible things, quote-unquote, are you talking about getting done that require an absence of truth? And how is it that truth gets in the way of common ground while lies are not even mentioned? After all, if something's not true, then it's a lie. And before we move on, I really have to congratulate and compliment Roseanne Barr, not only for having come to terms with her political dyslexia, but to overcome it in a significant way and to tell us all about her journey. I mean, she ran for president as leader of the Green Party, openly declaring herself to be a socialist, and now having correctly arrived at the conclusion that the left is just a fascist structure.
And that's why we need laws forbidding that kind of speech to protect them.
Well, that's a pretty terrible idea.
Yeah, and that's because you're not affected.
No, I just think that giving the government the freedom to restrict one group's individual freedoms or liberties to protect another sets a pretty horrifying precedent.
Yeah, you would say that, fascist.
I'll be right back.
E-S-F-F-F-A.
There we go. Farthingale, fascia board, fascinate, fascine, a bundle of sticks, see also fat. Whoa, there we are, fascism.
What does it say?
Oh, it says you're a f***ing moron.
Where the political dyslexia comes in her associating explicit and exclusive values of the right with the left. Freedom of speech, civil rights, self-improvement through education, individual rights. I mean, the left represents out-and-out collectivism, artificial group rights, and always has. But Roseanne's acknowledgement of that reality was something she interpreted as the left doing an hourglass flip. But the hourglass is Roseanne. And when she confessed that it may have always been that way, but I didn't perceive it that way, she confirmed the reality of that situation. Now, coming up on this side of the next bumper, two end-to-end discussions on the concept of the consent of the governed, one between Joe Rogan and Tucker Carlson, and the other with Carl Benjamin as Sargon of Akkad, while on the return side of the bumper, Canada Poly's Mark Paralivos despairs at the lack of a political solution to our current democratic tyranny.
Members of Congress are terrified of the intel agencies. I'm not guessing at that. They've told me that, including people on the intel committee, including people who run the intel committee, the people whose job it is to oversee and keep in line these enormous secretive agencies whose budgets we can't even know, their black budgets, they're the parents, the agencies are the children. They're afraid of the agencies. That's not compatible with democracy. Democracy is a really simple system, even representative democracy like ours. The people rule. They do so through elections. They express their preference through voting. They send their people to the capital city to run the government on their behalf. Whenever you have unelected people who are not accountable to anyone making the biggest decisions, you don't have a democracy. You have something else, another system. I would call it a tyranny or whatever you want to call it. It's not a democracy. So that's like super obvious. It's playing out in front of everyone and no one cares and no one does anything about it. And I think the reason is because they're threatened. And if you look at the committee chairmen who allow this shit to happen year after year, they're all, and I don't know, people say, oh, they're compromised or being blackmailed or whatever. I don't have evidence of that, but I know them and they all have things to hide. I know that for a fact. And so it's not a stretch of imagination to imagine that, you know, some committee chairman who's allowing warrantless spying on Americans to continue or whatever abuse they're allowing, knowing fully or hiding the truth about UAPs, ignoring the UAP Disclosure Act of 2023, like, why are they doing that? It's not impossible to imagine that some guy with a drinking problem or a weird sex life, and that's very common up there, that's why they're doing it. Because they don't want to be exposed. I don't have evidence of that. I don't have proof of that.
Right.
But that's not a crazy thing to assume that that could be happening. And I said to somebody, a very powerful person, the other day in a conversation in my kitchen, an elected official holds a really senior position, a very famous person. I was going crazy. I was so mad about all this stuff and about the warrantless spying and about the funding for these insane wars. And I said to the guy who serves in one of the legislative bodies, I got so mad my dogs were afraid. They're like, whoa, why are you yelling? Because I don't yell at home. But I was like, all these people are controlled. They're all, you know, got weird sex lives and all these things are hiding and they're being blackmailed by the intel agencies. And he said, and I'm quoting, I know. I was like, okay, so at this point, we're just sort of admitting that's real? Like, why do we allow that to continue?
The having people compromise thing, God, that's an old story.
It's the oldest story.
J. Edgar Hoover. I mean, it's all of them. It's Epstein's Island. It's everything.
But look, I don't have any. I'm telling you, what's the phrase the finance guys use? Open kimono. Like, I'm actually telling you all I know. I don't know anything else.
Right.
But I know that the publicly available facts tell a really clear story, which is the government is not acting on behalf of the population. And so it's inherently illegitimate because its only legitimacy derives from the citizenry. The only reason the government can do things that it does, kill people, collect money by force, all the powers that it has come from one place, and that's the consent of the governed. That's the only legitimacy they have.
It's well understood that the founding fathers of the United States, in particular Thomas Jefferson, were heavily influenced by liberal thinker John Locke. Writing to retrospectively justify the Glorious Revolution of 1688, Locke set out his foundational view of English liberalism in his famous Second Treatise of Government. Locke was writing in direct rebuttal to Sir Robert Filmer's traditional view that the king and the state were divinely ordained and instituted by God. In Locke's view, isolated men in the state of nature, subject to natural law, had made the rational decision to live together in society to protect themselves and their property, and therefore the state was created after this event, and its sole duty was to preserve the people themselves and that which they had accumulated. Locke repeatedly refers to the preservation of, quote, life, liberty, and estate to refer to the proper role of government. And if government overreaches its mandate and becomes tyrannical, he identifies a right to revolt within the people on the basis that the kind of government that rules over them was chosen by them due to it being conformable to their sensibilities, which could at any time be revoked when it is commonly agreed that the state has lost the consent of the governed, which is the only legitimating factor upon which liberal democracy is based. We find Locke's formulation expressed almost word for word in the Declaration of Independence, which was authored by Thomas Jefferson. When, in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bonds which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to separation. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive to those ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. The only notable difference is that Jefferson exchanges the term estate in Life, Liberty, and Estate for the pursuit of happiness, which is, of course, a broader statement, but does not exclude the accumulation of property. Otherwise, we see Locke's exact formulation of the origin of the state and the rights of the people replicated here. What this expressly does is to render the Republic and government of the United States a non-sacred enterprise. It is an explicitly rational one, created by men, for men, and for the purposes of men. It is wholly temporal and built to serve, not divinely ordained to rule.
This kind of stuff is going to be used, and I'm just showing it as an example of, and I mean, I don't know who this is. It kind of looks like Rance Derrick, but it's not Rance Derrick. He's advocating for violence. I'm not advocating for violence, but I don't know that there's a political solution. But this kind of stuff will be cited by the government as a credible threat. And they use that, and then I'll show you in the next series of tabs, they use that to meaningfully change their operating procedures to limit transparency and our ability to hold police officers accountable. So I don't agree with doing this kind of stuff. People can say what they want, et cetera, but this guy putting this out there is not helpful. And again, I'm showing this as an example of things that that the government and the police will use to justify further crackdowns. Okay, so here, I don't know if it's loud. We'll turn it down a little bit to start. Here we go.
Carbon tax, increase in GST, funding endless wars in Israel and the Ukraine, and almost zero funding for our own borders, and threats of World War III and another bullshit pandemic while we watch our cities being intentionally flooded with illegal migrants paid for with our tax dollars as we try to figure out how to pay our own goddamn bills while our politicians are importing a new voter base and then give themselves a new fucking raise. Canadians are getting f***ed. And these pricks aren't even trying to hide it anymore. Just look at Christina Friedlander, Castro Jr.'s face when asked a question. They don't even give you a goddamn answer. The only people they answer to is the WEF. Look, at some point, we're all going to have to stand up and say enough is enough. At some point, Canada Strong is going to have to wake up and kick Canada's...
So just to be clear, up until that point, you're probably nodding along, right? I was like, okay, this guy's enthusiastic, and he's got his, you know, rocking music in the background. He's doing his radio voice, right? And I thought, that at this point, he's like, now we have to kick their asses, and he starts advocating for violence. And it's like, man, why... I know that this is a very difficult problem to fix. And I understand that a political solution is not likely. Fine. They're going to use this against people who want to reestablish freedom and self-governance.
Because peacefully protesting isn't working anymore. Look, the only way a government runs properly is when it fears its populace. We don't have political leaders anymore. Now we have self-styled elitists. Political leaders that deem half of its citizens as racist and misogynistic. Political overlords that write bills criminalizing.
I don't know that the leadership needs to fear the population. I wouldn't want to govern a place where I feared the population. I would fear consequences of my actions in the court. I would fear if I was doing something like telling people experimental injection was safe and effective. I'd say, how do I know that it's safe and effective? I don't know that it's safe and effective. You're telling me, but how do I know you know? And so on, right? Like I would, doing that, I would fear the backlash from the residents that I was trying to govern. Flooding the country with illegal migrants and then getting my taxpayer base to pay for it, Again, I don't know that I would be worried that Canadians would show up at my door with a pitchfork, but maybe I'd be arrested and then charged for that. That's what we should fear, that everybody is being held to the same legal standard. And if you commit treason, that you're going to have consequences for that. And people will find out because transparency is paramount and so on and so forth. I don't know that I want to run a place, or I don't know that I want to live in a place where roving mobs of angry people show up periodically, because I mean, like, you could rally some people to do that. I've seen Beauty and the Beast, right? Let's go kill the Beast. Is that the best way to deal with this? Probably not, right? And so, like, man, it's a situation where I understand the passion, I understand the anger, but I am suspicious. I've got suspicious eyebrows here because he's saying, you know, we've got to make sure those politicians fear us. And I think that we should have laws that make it so if the politician is messing around, then they're going to have a lot of problems with the law. If you commit treason, we're going to arrest you and we're going to really make it uncomfortable for you. Like, don't you dare. But at this point, like, people are committing treason and it doesn't matter. Like, that's like a Tuesday, right? Like,
says Canada Polly, I don't think there's a political solution. I know this is a difficult problem to fix, and I know that a political solution is not likely. But the government is going to use calls for physical threat against people who want to reestablish freedom and self-government. End quote. So both force and persuasion have been ruled out as political solutions by Canada Polly. He's backed himself into an irresolvable dilemma by rejecting both of the only two possible means of resolving political conflicts, ballots or bullets. And the inescapable reality is that even if bullets, our metaphor for violence and force, are used to overthrow the government, politics is still the only means available to not only, quote-unquote, reestablish freedom and self-government, but also to maintain a tyranny. Which brings us back to the principle of consent of the governed. Quote, to those who consent, no injustice is done, end quote. You know, I've got a Freedom Party t-shirt with that quotation on its back. Now for some simple examples of how that principle might be applied. Consider two heavyweight champion boxers getting into a ring for a physical fight that might otherwise be considered an assault, but is not so classified because each of the contestants have consented to being the target of the physical force of the other. If it should happen that one of the fighters permanently injures or even kills his opponent, he cannot be subject to criminal charges, all other things being equal. Similarly, when we sign consent papers in a hospital or in a dentist's office before undergoing some kind of surgical procedure, we are actually consenting to be assaulted by virtue of that surgical procedure. I actually heard a doctor describe it that way. And I remember during my recent hospitalization this past November, I recall having to sign and initial several pages of consent forms as I was being wheeled into the surgical theater. And then there was the spectacle of the whole COVID fraud and the experimental gene therapies described to people as being a vaccine. Recipients of the purported vaccine were not informed of the identity of that vaccine or the risks involved. And therefore, we can reasonably argue that their informed consent was fraudulently obtained and an injustice was done to them. But when it comes to the broader political concept of the consent of the governed, most people incorrectly assume that this consent is being given through the voting process, during which we can choose our democratic representatives from a given number of political contestants in a given riding. But that's just a small part of the picture. The process occurring during elections is called consensus. It's not consent. The principle behind consensus is that the majority, however defined, wins, while the minority must comply to the majority's wishes. It's a collective concept. The principle behind consent is purely an individualistic one, in which each individual exercises that consent through chosen and voluntary relationships with other individuals. And a key principle behind consent is that children cannot legally consent, okay? One must have reached the age of majority or the age of consent before legally being able to exercise that franchise. Now, of course, it can't be ignored that not everyone who lives in a given country or jurisdiction has a vote. And even many who do have the right to vote don't. Political consent is an act of acquiescence. It does not require agreement, support, action, or the signing of documents or consent forms. The consent is demonstrated by one's voluntary participation of living under a given political jurisdiction. And if you don't like it, as they say, leave, as many Canadians have done since the COVID scam. You can think of it like a Monopoly game or a game of chess. The players consent to the rules of the game in advance by participating in the game according to the given rules. Most importantly, the loser consents to allowing the winner to win when the game is over. In terms of the political left and right polarity, the left never consents to losing an election, while the right generally allows the left to rule when the right loses an election. In fact, the left doesn't even consent to playing the game fairly, as is aptly demonstrated by the absurd attacks on Donald Trump, or by the fact that both America and Canada actually have 100% bona fide political prisoners in their custody. We live in a tyranny. It's obvious. No one does anything because they're threatened, says Tucker Carlson. The government's not acting on behalf of the population, therefore is illegitimate, because consent of the governed is the only legitimacy. Meanwhile, Carl Benjamin, as Sargon of Akkad, reminds us that the Republic of the United States is a non-sacred enterprise. It is exclusively a rational one created by the people, for the people, and for the purposes of men. It is wholly temporal and built to serve, not divinely ordained to rule, he says. And you know, that's a point rarely emphasized, as so many people believe that only a government founded under some kind of recognition of the quote-unquote supremacy of God is capable of establishing a free nation. But history has demonstrated that such governments often succumb to the formula of the three G's: God, government, and guns, the holy trinity of divine statism. It should be noted as well that the American Constitution does not have even one single reference to God, and despite its currently being put under attack by the left, is still the major stumbling block to the woke leftist agenda. So in addressing Canada Pauly's assertion that this is a difficult problem to fix and that a political solution is not likely, let me conclude with this. It is difficult, but political solutions are the only way to fix political problems. For freedom, the fixes are easy to identify, but not easy to attain when your fellow citizens continue to suffer from political dyslexia, causing them to consent to their own tyranny. And in the process, they are forcing a consensus that establishes that tyranny on all of us. And politics is not just about voting. It's about doing the kinds of things that we do right here at Just Right. Fighting on the front lines of the information war, which is something you can also participate in, by joining us again next week as we continue our journey in the right direction. Until then, be right, stay right, do right, act right, think right, and be right back here. We'll see you then.
Fade into color. Color into black and white. Under the bedclothes, everything will be alright.
Oh, Edith, the Democrats is doing a whole. The Democrats. And you put them in there. That's the face you had on you when you come back in the polls. Well, the Democrats' way of running this country is to go tell us all how we ought to make sacrifices. God, they're great on that stuff. But they're all going to have us over the hill to the poorhouse. We ain't going to be able to drive over there because we ain't got no gas, so we're going to have to walk it.
Oh, the Reader's Digest says walking is very good for you.
Oh, ain't that lovely? The Reader's Digest can always put a little joy into poverty. Listen, my whole painting. My whole point is this whole thing with the energy and everything. This is all a conspiracy. No, you know that? It's a conspiracy there. Listen, for years, all our lives, they've been telling us to go out and buy stuff that use energy. You know, all electrical stuff. We got electric toasters, electric ovens, electric stove, electric stereo, electric TV, electric race, electric hair blower, electric knives, electric every damn thing. Not to mention the cars. And now, after all the big corporations there make the billions and billions of dollars worth of profits, signals, wham, they're changed. and had to tell us for years that we can't live without this junk. Now they tell us that we gotta live without it. The country is going straight into the dumper.